Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Enigma Strain by Nick Thacker, narrated by David DeVries. Prologue. Alexei Expedition, Northwest Territory, Canada, 1704. The sound of another exploding tree caused Nikolai Alexei to jump. He heard the men behind him snicker, but he did not care to address them. It was not worth his time, and besides, it was poor leadership to acknowledge such pettiness. His father had explained the odd occurrence to him on a wolf-hunting trip when he was a boy. The frozen tree sap inside the trunks of the pines would expand, causing the bark and wood to explode. He had often lain awake at night, counting the rippling explosions as they worked their way through the wooded area around their cabin. He knew the sound well, but it still took him by surprise when it happened, even now. He grumbled to himself and marched onward through the knee-deep snow. He enjoyed this land. It reminded him of home, of the countless miles of deep black forest filled with the same animals he used to hunt, the same trees he used to climb, and the same bitter cold he used to long for with fresh blankets of snow thick enough to halt a horse. He remembered the smells, too, the ripe evergreens and the sheer emptiness of the air. He was more comfortable in the woods than any of his men, with the possible exception of Lev. And yet their laughter frustrated him. It was not a sign of insubordination as much as it was a sign of their laziness. For 3 months they had made their trek over mountains and across valleys so high and so deep, he had thought they would not make it to the other side with their entire crew intact. They had crossed tundra, plateaus, and wetlands, all without losing a man. Their hunting excursions were always successful, and most nights ended around a large bonfire with a deer roasting on a spit. Breakfast was hot soup, and they snacked on smoked meats throughout the day. Nikolai had to admit that so far it was one of the more successful expeditions he had been on, and he knew God was smiling on them in this new land. But he knew also that it made them weak, it made them soft. They had grown fat and sluggish, covering less ground each day than the day before. Their energy and excitement had been replaced with a restlessness that had turned their stories and poems around the fire into passionless songs. Without glancing back, Nikolai called out behind him, "Doctor?" A short, thin man struggled through the snow, but Nikolai did not slow his pace. "We will stop and make camp when we next find a clearing. The river is to the north, and we can fish there for as long as we like." "Split the men into crews of 2 and 3, Nikolai said, "and I will send them out in the morning to chart the area. These Cossacks will find pleasure in a change of scenery, and I myself will enjoy an excursion of a more solitary nature." Nikolai was a man of his word, a man of integrity. He had promised the Tsar a map of the deep terrain of North America, and he intended to deliver it. His expedition had grown mundane, and it was time to bring it back to life. "So you will wander alone through these parts?" the doctor asked. Nikolai laughed. "I will take care not to lose myself in the fog, if that is what you are asking. Sometimes a man must wander, my friend," he said. "But rest assured, we will gather together after 3 days." The doctor nodded and fell in line behind his leader. Nikolai was uncertain if this plan of his would do more good than it would endanger them all, but it was a risk he was willing to take. They had found nothing useful thus far, nothing the motherland would be inclined to return to claim. Cartography was their stated manifest, but he was under no false pretenses. By moving outward in smaller groups, the expedition could cover more territory and more ground than by moving in a single line. So far they had charted the great river to their north all the way from the sea, but they knew that every river began somewhere, whether it was a lake amid the mountain peaks or from tributaries caused by glacial melt. He did not know, and he did not care. Nikolai Alexei was here for one reason and one reason alone. His homeland sought riches, as did his men. All men sought more than what God had initially blessed them with. It was a man's duty to find what he was owed in this life, with all the more blessings to be bestowed upon him in the afterlife. This new land was not known for its riches, but only a fool would think the Spanish had been capable of taming it when they came. This land was made for Russians. Only they understood it. This great unknown that had attracted Nikolai was an opportunity that he was not going to let pass. Prologue. Alexei Expedition, Northwest Territory, Canada, 1704. When the first star appeared in the heavens above them, the men made camp, throwing oilskins over tent poles in a circle by the riverbank. They were slow, Nikolai noted. After the last few days' effort, it did not surprise him, but it did not please him much either. It took over an hour to set up the 10 tents and build the fire, but no more than 10 minutes for the men to begin huddling around it. Soon the moon rose nearly full. A meal was prepared, a roasted deer and herb soup, and the men began singing. But Nikolai had had enough. He broke away from the camp and lifted the moose-skin hood up and over his head. This Siberian Yupik coat was one of the best trades he had made. The bitter cold tried to bite into his flesh, and the gentle wind threatened to chill his core, but he didn't notice. He made for a smaller clearing to the south that he had seen earlier, one with a rock outcropping against a higher mountain cliff. The river they were following had likely cut down into this valley they were currently in, and if he was lucky, it had left some interesting formations for him. He reached the clearing and scared away a small beaver that would make a fine pelt when it reached adulthood, and stepped out into the open grassy area to get a good look at the outcropping. It appeared that the boulders were precariously situated around a hole near the ground, beckoning him closer. As he approached, he could see, even in this failing light, that what he had found was an opening to a small cave. He had no light with him, but he ducked inside anyway. It was useless. He could explore little with just hands and arms. Tomorrow, he would head here first thing, bring a torch and a few extra men. This was the type of cave that would have made a perfect shelter for one of the native tribes that might call this place home. So far they had not encountered any such people, but he had no way of knowing if these indigenous tribes he had heard tell of lived along these rivers or not. A light appeared behind him, flickering and orange. He could almost feel the heat of the torch as it grew brighter.
"Nikolai," a voice said softly. "Is that you?"
It was the doctor's voice, a little unsure.
"Yes, doctor," Nikolai said. He felt the excitement within him growing. "Bring the light. I would very much like to have a look at this place."
The doctor joined him and lifted the flaming torch up in front of them. Scrawled upon the walls were dozens of paintings articulating dancing men and women around fires, hunting trips, and deaths. So many deaths. One particularly macabre image depicted a man and woman lying sideways next to each other, their arms crossed as in a representation of death. 6 children were drawn below them haphazardly as if added at different times in the past. Nikolai and the doctor gazed at the drawings, trying to decipher their meaning. Sections of paintings had been scratched out or painted over, as if the original author had changed the story halfway through.
"I don't understand. Do you, sir?"
Nikolai didn't respond. He took the torch from the other man's hand and continued on deeper into the cave. A few feet past the first wall, the ceiling grew higher, and he drew himself up to his full height. More cave paintings decorated the walls to his left and right, and arrows were drawn near the floor. Farther on, in the small cavern twisted to the left and ended in a rounded chamber. He swung the torch around this room, at first looking for a continuation of the path he was on. Finding none, he held the torch lower. Stacks of bones and skulls lay atop one another, of all shapes and sizes. Men, women, and children all lay close together, though arranged in what he assumed must have been families. In front of these,
He found baskets made from sinewy animal skins with lids fashioned from skin and bones. The leather work was remarkable, and he reached down to grab one. He examined it closely, handing the light to the doctor. Stamped into the sides and top of the basket were designs and symbols that he could not interpret. They swirled around the edges, leaving no section of leather untouched.
"Beautiful," he whispered.
He twisted the top of the basket, finding the lid secured tightly, either by design or from years of rest. He gave the lid a harder twist and felt a pop. The top of the basket came off, sending dust shooting through the air. He waved it away and dropped the lid to the ground. He saw what was inside, and only then realized how heavy the basket was. He turned the basket upside down, emptying its contents out onto the cave floor. Hundreds of silver coins bounced on the dirt and rolled around.
"For the glory of..."
the doctor said, his voice hoarse.
"I imagine this is the sort of thing we have come here for," Nikolai said.
He scooped up a handful of the silver coins and held them up to the light. "Do you recognize these?"
"No, I have never seen such a design."
Upon the surface of each coin was a remarkably intricate design, either hand-carved or stamped. It featured the bust of a native man, and Nikolai could even see the outline of a frown on his face. He was surrounded by what looked like fire, each wisp carefully measured and drawn.
"From the local population?" the doctor asked.
Nikolai shook his head.
"No. The people here use the shells of clams as their currency, and most simply trade goods instead. This must be from somewhere else entirely."
He flipped it over in his hand. The back was a reflection of the front, with the same native man frowning up at them. The fire, however, was markedly absent from this side. In its place were swirls and lines which looked to be framing the man in the center.
"Fire on the one side, wind on the other,"
Nikolai whispered. "A dichotomy. What could it represent?"
"What is in the other baskets?"
the doctor asked. He reached for another, trying at first to lift it from the ground. The basket slid a few inches toward him, but stayed on the floor.
"This one is considerably heavier, sir," he said.
Nikolai reached down and twisted the lid free. He pushed the basket over with his right foot and watched as more silver coins tumbled out, identical to the one in his hand.
"Doctor," he said, "bring the men, and bring the satchels as well. I count at least 20 of these baskets. What about you?"
The doctor shook his head excitedly.
"Perhaps more."
"If each contains even a portion of what is in these first two, it should be more than enough to justify a return home, do you think?"
The doctor smiled. Nikolai wasn't greedy, but he felt the stirrings of excitement growing in his chest. He would share this treasure with his men without question, but he needed to be sure of what he had found. He moved to the back of the cavern, now standing directly in front of the pile of skeletons. Reaching down, he lifted the lid on one of the baskets that had been placed close to the back. More dust spread outward from the freshly opened container, and he blinked and waved it away with his free hand. He moved the torch down closer to the top of the basket and peered inside. It was empty.
Odd.
He reached for the basket nearest it and lifted its lid, too. Empty, save for a few small tools. He considered calling the doctor back, but stopped himself.
Why would they bury them here? He wondered. Why would they place a nearly empty basket next to a tribute to their deceased loved ones?
Had someone come before him? Someone who had found the baskets and emptied what they could?
It did not make sense. Anyone who had explored this cave before them would certainly have emptied it of its treasures. They would not have left anything of value behind, and they would not have put the lids back on each basket. Thieves were anything but tidy.
Yet these two baskets were empty? He looked again, this time lifting one of the baskets to eye level and turning it. He could see the fine sinewy lines of the bottom woven together and sewn shut. A few tools shifted at the bottom,
what looked like a few small pipes, a bowl made of clay, and some other small sticks and rocks. He coughed and realized for the first time how thick the dust in the air had become. Waving his hands, he backed away from the burial site. He coughed again, and this time felt his lungs strain with the effort. He turned away from the room and walked back upward until the cave ceiling closed in on him. He stepped out into the small clearing. Night had fallen completely, and thousands of stars peered down at him. He fell to his knees, trying to catch his breath. He sucked in air, forcing his lungs back open again. He struggled forward, then rolled onto his back in the snow. Nikolai struggled to calm his thinking and shut his eyes.
Breathe.
He willed himself to breathe in and out until he felt the dust clearing from his system. His breathing became normal and controlled. Just then, he heard the footsteps of his men running toward the clearing. He stood and brushed the snow from his back. He lifted his head and walked towards the edge of the woods.
"Have you retrieved the satchels?"
"We have, sir. Where is the cave?"
The voice was Lev's, the huge bear of a man tumbling out of the woods first. His eyes were wide, and his breath was heavy, pouring out of his mouth and nose in great bursts. With scars on his face and body from a lifetime serving his homeland as a soldier and a woodsman, Nikolai enjoyed the man's company and trusted his skill as a dedicated naturalist who was as knowledgeable as himself. Nikolai gestured to the entrance. The group, 15 men in all, trotted past and soon emerged three at a time with their satchels heavy. The endeavor took only 30 minutes, and they joined Nikolai in the clearing when they were finished. Only four of the baskets had been empty, including the two Nikolai had found. If the men were jovial before, they were near ecstatic now. They knew their leader was a fair and honest man, and they would each get a good portion of the discovery. The primary cartographer among them, Rorik, began scratching some notes into a small notebook he had produced from his pocket. He measured the edges of the clearing, counting each step as he went, and drawing them into this book. When he finished, he nodded to Nikolai and they returned to the main camp.
"We leave tomorrow," Nikolai said as the other men gathered around. "We have added too much weight to continue the expedition for now, and it will be a burden already with the water and food we must carry with us." Cheers erupted around the fire, and the men broke into song. Nikolai wondered how men could be so merry without the aid of spirits and drink, but he did not stifle the mood. He silently stepped away from the doctor and Lev and entered his tent. As the leader of this expedition, he shared it with no other man, and he enjoyed the privilege. He slipped off his coat and nestled onto his cot. The noise around the campfire grew, but Nikolai could hardly hear it. He felt as if his mind was on fire, as if his head was being held above a pot of boiling water. He started to sweat, and his hands and arms began to itch. Nikolai struggled to stifle the burning sensation and considered calling out for the doctor's aid. Before he could, however, he drifted into a welcome and deep sleep.
Prologue. Alexei Expedition, Northwest Territory, Canada, 1704. Nikolai awoke the next morning to an odd sound. Silence. Pure, pristine winter silence. The quiet he had not heard since before they had left Russia. The quiet of his youth. Intense and intimidating. Nikolai would normally have welcomed it with a sharp sniff and a deep, satisfying breath. But this morning should not have been so quiet. An expedition with a group of almost 30 men guaranteed that every moment would be filled with some racket or another. He threw the blankets off and stood. His head brushed the top pole of his tent as he opened the flaps. The fire had long since diminished, though wisps of cold ash rose with the gentle breeze, giving the appearance of smoke. The cluster of tents was situated in a circle around the fire, like spokes on a wagon wheel. His tent was the northernmost one, and separated from the others on each side by a few rows of trees. The tents were traditional, two vertical poles and a horizontal one resting atop them,
with canvas stretched over it and staked into the ground at the corners. Each tent was immaculately placed, perfectly spaced, and set up to look exactly the same. His men were good men, Nikolai knew, and they cared deeply for these small details. But where were they? Why weren't they preparing for their long journey home?
Doctor? Lev?
He called out. He entered the nearest to find the two men still asleep beneath mounds of blankets and furs. He kicked at the doctor's cot with an unlaced boot and asked again. Hearing nothing in return, Nikolai pulled the blankets from the man's head. The outermost blanket, a thick woven fabric, caught on something, and he struggled to pull it down. After a more forceful tug, the blanket fell away to reveal the flesh of the doctor's face, eaten by a rash, red boils covering the surface of his skin. Nikolai stumbled backward in disgust. A portion of the skin on the poor man's forehead had stuck to the blanket, glued there by dried tissue and blood. The doctor's eyes were open, but they were glazed over in death. Instinctively, Nikolai clutched a hand to his mouth, struggling to hold back the vomit he felt rising in his throat. He pulled the blanket away completely and found every inch of exposed skin on the doctor's body covered in similar boils. He turned to Lev's cot and made the same cursory examination. More rash, more boils, more death. Lev had also passed some time during the night. Both men lay in their blankets, gazing up at the roof of the tent with blank eyes. Nikolai moved away, closed the flap behind him. He looked down at his own hands and arms and noticed the same rash spread and thickened over most of his skin. It was no longer itchy, but he felt the heat radiating from his skin on the places around his body that had been infected. Last night, it was just his hands and arms. Now he felt it over his shoulders, neck, and upper back. He checked two more tents, finding the same horrifying faces staring up at him in each. All of his men, all 27 of them, were dead. He was the sole survivor on an expedition that was now thousands of miles away from home in one of the remotest places known to man. Another tree cracked in the distance, and he knew that winter was about to set in for good. Chapter 1. Yellowstone National Park, Wyoming. Present day. Harvey Ben Bennett eased the end of his rifle through the small space between the two bushes. He readjusted his left knee, moving a rock to the side of the bush he had crushed under his jeans. He held the rifle steady, using a stray branch as a platform. He watched the scene through the end of the scope. The grizzly was busy rummaging through the food from an overturned cooler in the clearing. The female, small for her age but no less dangerous, grunted in delight as she discovered bits of bacon and pancakes from that morning's breakfast. The campers had long since fled, calling the main park line and complaining of a nuisance bear in the area. They were worried the bear would enter their camp and scare their kids, or worse. Worried the bear would do what it was designed to do, Ben thought. These types of campers were the worst kind. They left a mess, complained constantly, and ruined the sanctity of the ecosystem they'd stumbled into. People from the cities treated camping like a luxury all-inclusive resort vacation, as if nature was designed specifically to please them. Ben hated them, almost as much as he hated this part of his job. Nuisance animals, everything from raccoons to grizzlies, were a major turnoff for visitors and tourists, and therefore a problem. People had no idea how to handle animals looking for an easy meal, and tended to freak out and assume they were under attack, rather than calmly leave the scene and find a ranger. Ben slid around into the chamber and took aim. He closed each eye in turn, checking the distance, and trying to gauge where the bear would move next. His left eye provided him a view of the attached manometer as he peered through the scope, allowing him to adjust for pressure without losing sight of the target. The aluminum barrel and American walnut stock felt warm in his hands, alive. It was a comfortable weapon, and Ben was satisfied with the department's purchase of these relocation tools. He watched the bear's thick neck muscles throb as she tore off a chunk of cardboard from the pile of smelly trash she'd discovered. That was the other thing Ben hated about these people. They had no intention of learning anything. How to cook, what to eat in the woods, how to find food. They just wanted the comforts of home in a temporary excursion from reality. The bear straightened its neck slightly, and Ben suddenly caught a glimpse of her left eye. It glistened with age, a sheen of gray sparkling in the corner. Mo. Ben recognized the grizzly from the other times he'd encountered her down here. He had helped a few crews move her only months ago last summer, and again 2 years prior to that. Ben sighed and focused on the air leaving his lungs. He sucked in a quick, small breath and held it in. He counted to 5 and pulled the trigger. The soft popping sound took him by surprise. It always did. The juxtaposition of the man-made machine he'd just fired was severely out of place in what was supposed to be a pristine environment. Yet here he was adding to the mess, and he was immediately remorseful. The bear bristled and sat straighter, her back still to Ben. She turned slowly, her head lolling around as the tranquilizer began to take effect. Mo wouldn't charge him. The projectile dart alone wouldn't have alarmed the bear any more than if a small branch had fallen on her. But Ben knew the 2 milligrams of atorfin and acepromazine maleate compound the dart had just injected into the side of the bear would be more than enough to drop it. Ben waited, not wanting to alert the bear. Angering or exciting an animal just before they fell asleep would cause undue stress, and it may even put them in danger. After a few more seconds, the bear let out a low moan as she stood on her hind feet. She turned in an unsteady circle, then fell back to the ground. The grizzly lay down on the damp leaves, and her head fell to the forest floor. Ben waited a full minute before stepping out of his hiding spot. He pushed through the bushes, not bothering to spread the brambles apart, and crossed the clearing and stood over the animal. "Sorry about that, Mo," he said softly. "Let's get you back up north again." He removed the small CO2 cartridge from under the barrel of the rifle and dropped it in his pocket. He crouched down and found the red feather-tipped dart protruding from the bear's left flank. The dart was expensive and reusable, and the department prohibited rangers from leaving them in the parks even if they were damaged or destroyed. Ben unclipped the walkie-talkie from his belt and rotated the knob at the top. "This is Bennett," he said into the device. "I've got Mo dropped up here, requesting assistance to get her cleared." The radio crackled, then came to life. "Okay, tag the location and stand by for location verification. We're sending out a crew. Out." Ben tucked his radio away and took out his phone. He tapped an app on the home screen and clicked around a few times, setting his current location into the device's memory, then turned on the GPS beacon. Within minutes, a crew of 4 men and 2 women arrived at the campsite and began strapping the grizzly onto a board. The rangers would move Mo to another area of the park with less human traffic. She would eventually wander down again, drawn to the enticing opportunity ignorant campers left her. This was Mo's 3rd repositioning, and Ben was worried it would be her last. "Don't come back down here, Mo," Ben willed the sleeping giant. "I won't be able to help you out again." Chapter 2. The Chevy hiccuped over an invisible pothole in the road, and the aging suspension compensated with a clicking sound and a groan. Ben pulled the truck to the left, easing it back to the center of the narrow dirt road before turning the radio up. The country song already blaring through the strained cabin speakers didn't need a boost, but it got one anyway.
"You really don't like to talk, do you?"
Ben's passenger yelled. The young man sitting to Ben's right glanced over at him. Ben kept his attention on the uneven road lying before them. Out of the corner of his eye, Ben noticed Carlos Rivera turning back to looking out his side window. Over the past hour, Ben had said maybe 10 words, and what he had said was mainly instructive, telling Rivera to call into base, or checked Mo in the truck bed. To his credit, Rivera had dutifully done as he was told, but...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?